This message comes from Capital One. Your business faces unique challenges and opportunities. That's why Capital One offers a comprehensive suite of financial services backed by the strength of a top 10 commercial bank. Visit CapitalOne.com/commercial. Member FDIC.
Bullseye with Jesse Thorne is a production of MaximumFun.org and is distributed by NPR.
It's Bullseye. I'm Jesse Thorne. How many jokes are in the movie Airplane? One movie blog says 223. Another says 178. How many minutes are in the movie Airplane? Well, that one's easier to find out. 88, according to the back of the VHS box in my cabin. In any case, that's over two jokes per minute. So many jokes! But it isn't just about volume. For one thing, those jokes are basically all perfect. I mean, they are profoundly dumb in almost every case, but perfect. And so's the tone. The cast is full of serious actors, folks from B-movie dramas and TV police procedurals. Every bit of silly nonsense is delivered like it was the address of a crime scene on Dragnet. Nobody else has ever been able to replicate that combination of unhinged silliness and dead dry sincerity. It's a Zucker Abrams Zucker original. Those three guys wrote and directed Airplane, among many other films and TV shows, Police Squad, Top Secret, several of the scary movies. They started in a homemade theater in Wisconsin, a theater that they actually literally built themselves. Then they took it apart, they put it in a U-Haul, and they rebuilt it in Los Angeles, inside an abandoned halfway house. They were a phenomenon, and their stage shows became a tiny film, Kentucky Fried Movie, then a huge film, Airplane, and ultimately a cultural phenomenon that endures today. David Zucker, Jim Abrams, and Jerry Zucker recently wrote a book. It's called Surely You Can't Be Serious, The True Story of Airplane. And it's not strictly a book about Airplane. It's a book about a collaboration that's lasted almost half a century. It's a book about ZAZ's triumphs and disappointments, and it's a book about how to make something funny. There's even a list of comedy rules. We'll get into the list later. In the meantime, we won't delay any further my conversation with David Zucker, Jim Abrams, and Jerry Zucker. David, Jim, Jerry, welcome to Bullseye. I'm so happy to get to talk to you.
We're happy to be here.
David and Jerry, I'm pretty sure I know how the two of you met, but how did Jim enter your lives?
Well, our fathers were business partners, our mothers were friends, and our sisters were college roommates, and we'd see Jim walking in the halls of the high school, and so we kind of got to know each other.
The families have a long history.
Jim, what did you think of them?
We were kids when we met. And I'm still 3 years older than David and 6 years older than Jerry. So, you know, as kids, that's kind of a big difference. So, you know, our families were good friends and we'd get together and everything was fine. But we really didn't get together as, like, to play around together until, you know, many years later. And I ran into David one time in Milwaukee. I was a private investigator and he was a construction expediter. And he said he had this stuff called videotape equipment. And he wanted to know if I wanted to come over because we all knew each other, had similar senses of humor, and wanted to know if I wanted to come over and play with this videotape equipment, which I knew nothing about. So we did. We got together in David and Jerry's basement. I think Jerry was just finishing college. And we'd get together on the weekends and just mess around with videotape equipment and, you know, do spoofs of contemporary TV ads or movies and just for the fun of it.
Where'd you guys get video equipment?
Our dad had a friend who ran a sickroom service thing, and they had a videotape machine to do demonstrations of things. And he told my dad that he could, you know, David could borrow it, and because I was still in school, and Dad thought it would be great for David to make industrial videos, you know, and David had no interest in that whatsoever. But then he saw this show in Chicago, which was inspired by Kenny Shapiro's Groove Tube. You know, the shows where a whole bunch of people would be in a room and watch a TV. And in those days, you know, there were three channels, and to do R-rated stuff, you had to either do it yourself or a movie. And David just thought, this is what we should do. And he drove back to Madison, where I was, and started going on and on about, you know, doing a show. And so, you know, our dad got this equipment then, and it was great because you could film something and erase it, do something else, film it a different way. You could save stuff and edit it pretty easily all together. So it, for us, a videotape machine, it was this huge machine, and the quality was not anywhere near what your cell phone can achieve. But it was the greatest play tool, and it was really the reason why we got into this business.
It was also kind of a continuing obsession for the three of you to video record, like not just make your own stuff, but like for years you were recording the TV overnights so that you could watch them and enjoy the worst of American culture.
Well, we used them when we had the show, Kentucky Fried Theater. We would sometimes just use the video and put it on our own audio, or use the audio and put it on our own video. And so we were always, or sometimes we would just redo the whole thing. But for us, it was always great to look at the real thing that we were spoofing and say, stop the tape. Wait a minute. What if he did this or said that? And that really just continued on through all our satires.
Was it always spoofs and ideas? Or was there a time when you were doing characters and farces? You know what I mean?
No, always spoofs. I satire. I mean, not that one didn't creep in occasionally, or a skit in the show or something. But a lot of it, the thing we enjoyed the most was making fun of something that was done seriously.
But so occasionally we do something that was just completely silly. One of the early tapes I remember we did in the basement, Jim and I did this, you know, we played some very serious music and Jim was smoking a pipe and the camera came around and Jim looked in the camera and just spit out a ping pong ball. and that was just like, I have it. I just happened to come across that the other day because I've been putting some of these things on.
I actually don't know how you do it. How you did it, Jim? Because the other day I thought I came across a ping pong ball. I said this would be great. The next time I'm on a Zoom, you know, I'll put this in my mouth and just listen and then spit it out. And I couldn't. My mouth was all.
Did you really try that?
Yeah, it was really hard.
You mean 50 years ago when you saw Jim do that?
No, I tried it like 6 months ago.
You were on a Zoom 50 years ago?
Yeah,
that's a great idea. Yeah. I'm going to try to do that.
See if you could do that. Yeah. Maybe someone makes smaller ping pong balls. I don't know.
The introduction and everything. And then start talking.
Yeah.
Was there sketch stuff that you loved? Had you watched Monty Python on PBS when it was on TV and that kind of thing?
Yeah.
We liked Monty Python.
Monty Python's great. Yeah.
One of my favorite jokes is one of the Monty Python things where he's asked three questions.
Yeah.
And then the guy before him says, you know, is asked, what's your favorite color? And the guy says, green. And so they ask the next guy, who is Eric Idle or something. And the third question is, what's your favorite color? And Eric Idle says, green. And then he thinks, no, blue, you know, and then he gets thrown away.
Yeah,
it's my favorite joke. It's one great. Of my favorite jokes of all time.
I've been watching their TV, the old TV shows a lot lately, and they're just really funny and also very odd, which I love.
What was your idea of what show business was, the three of you in Milwaukee with a video recorder that maybe you could use to make industrials?
I think my mom used to go to New York every year for a week and see all the shows. And then she'd come back and we'd listen to my sisters and I, and she and family would listen to the albums over and over, and we'd memorize the story of the whatever the show was, you know, like Pajama Game and West Side Story and, you know, those from way back when. And so that was always my idea. It was like Broadway. That's what I thought show business was.
But we went to the West Coast.
Did you have your eyes set on Chicago or New York first?
I think my memory is that we had, first the show in Madison, it was just fun and a lark, and we loved doing it. And then after a while, it was, wait a minute, we don't want to stop doing this. It's really, it could be a vocation, or we wanted it to
and
be.
And we were only charging $1 a ticket.
A ticket, yeah.
At that point, we weren't getting rich.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And so, you know, obviously, I don't think we really considered Chicago as either New York or L.A.
Well, there was some discussion of Milwaukee. That's what Dick Chudnow said. He was our fourth partner and at the time. And Dick, and we were talking about, well, we can go to, I think there was a discussion, Milwaukee or Chicago, and Dick says, no, I'm going to L.A. I don't care what you guys are going to do. We're going to L.A., so.
I think we thought it would be easier to starve in Los Angeles than in New York.
Or Milwaukee.
Yeah. Or Milwaukee, yeah. No, Milwaukee, we had our parents.
And we could live at home at least.
Could leave at home.
Right. And we had this aspiration. Our ultimate goal was to be on The Tonight Show.
Yeah.
That was really the motivation to move to California.
And Jerry,
Johnny Carson had just moved there.
Jerry said in the book, if I could just be on Johnny Carson, then I could die.
And have lived a good life.
And have lived a good life, yeah.
That was what
that would be. That would
so
be
I guess we were hell-bent to be famous or something.
Right. Yeah.
Or at least on some scale.
Were you guys long-haired free spirits, or were you Midwestern squares? Where did you land on
that? We were long-haired squares.
Yeah.
I certainly was a long-haired free spirit. You know, maybe it probably varied.
Well, Jim had a straight job. He would have to go back to Milwaukee every, on Sunday night to get to his straight job in the morning.
Yeah, I was a private investigator for a law firm in Milwaukee, and they were very straight guys. And so all week long, I'd, you know, wear a suit and tie to work and be a straight guy. And then every Friday afternoon, I'd roll a joint and put it in the car and smoke it and go up to Madison and do the show. And it was a completely different world.
Yeah.
And then Monday, I'd drive back to Milwaukee.
And that all worked for Jim pretty well until there was a big article in the Milwaukee Journal about this wild, crazy show in Madison, partly run by Jim Abrahams of Milwaukee. And so his whole law firm read it. And, I mean, I don't know what the reaction was, but it...
They were appalled.
They were appalled.
Yeah, they were appalled.
but I think during all those years, especially in Los Angeles, Jim was always the adult in the room. So there are different. Dave and I, I'm the youngest, so I was the most kind of, wide-eyed
and you had never held an actual real job.
No.
From college.
My kids are always amazed that I actually have never had a resume.
Yeah.
So what led you to Skip Town, right? You had a life where you were making this comedy that you loved. You were doing it in a hip town that was a small lake where you were big fish. So why did you decide to move to this place that you had no idea about other than, a roadmap and a U-Haul rental?
Well, we thought we were a really great sketch comedy group. And And if we could get on the Tonight Show, we would just zoom straight to the top. So, you know, we had to go out. That was our goal. So that's why we left Madison and went to
I also think,
LA.
You know, we wanted to get into showbiz. I mean, yeah. You know, we kiddled about the Tonight Show, and that was a big deal and that we wanted to. And we ended up getting on and not being very good. But the real thing was that we loved what we were doing, and we wanted to do it professionally. And I think we would have considered being a performing group, being on television, film, anything. We're never thought of ourselves as directors. Periodically, we barely knew what a director did, and so it was really a passion for the humor we were doing and making people laugh. And we kind of, assumed that they laugh at the same, the things they laughed at in Madison, they would laugh at, pretty much laugh at in Los Angeles.
And we got great reviews in Madison and the audience and the show was packed. We didn't have any ad budget. Mm-hmm. It was just complete word of mouth. And so we knew we had something and we had something different. So, and that encouraged us to, I went out to LA a couple of months before we actually moved out, and we saw a couple of the groups that were popular in LA and San Francisco. And I just thought, I just really thought we were a lot better than that. So each step of the way, we would see what was there. Like we would see, Mel Brooks movies or Woody Allen movies, and we loved those movies, but we thought we could do that. So I think we were encouraged by just, seeing what was out there.
We've got even more to get into with David Zucker, Jim Abrams, and Jerry Zucker. On the other side of a quick break, we will talk about the movie that changed everything for them. Airplane with an exclamation mark. It's Bullseye from MaximumFun.org and NPR.
This message comes from NPR sponsor MassMutual. According to Calendar.com, the average person schedules just 4.5 hours per year on finances. MassMutual gets it. Life is busy. If you can't find time to plan your financial future, find someone who can, like a MassMutual financial professional. For the last 170 years, they've helped people plan for retirement, college tuition, and any other short or long-term financial goals. Learn more at MassMutual.com.
This message comes from NPR sponsor BetterHelp. When you keep your stress bottled up, it can eat away at you. Therapy is a safe space to get things off your chest and to figure out how to make them better. Try BetterHelp Online Therapy, designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Get it off your chest with BetterHelp at betterhelp.com/NPR today to get 10% off your first month.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Doubleday, publishers of Lessons in Chemistry. Be inspired. Read Lessons in Chemistry, the number one global bestseller with more than 6 million copies sold. Meet Elizabeth Zott, a 60s-era scientist who brings her smarts and unapologetic worldview to a TV cooking show that has the power to change lives. Lessons in Chemistry is available wherever books are sold from Doubleday.
Soundheap with John-Luke Roberts is a real podcast made up of fake podcasts. Like, if you had a cupboard in your lower back, what would you keep in it?
So I'm going to say mugs.
A little yogurt and a spoon.
A small handkerchief that was given to me by my grandmother on her deathbed.
Maybe some spare honey.
I'd keep batteries in it. I'd pretend to be a toy.
If I had a cupboard in my lower back, I'd probably fill it with spines.
If you had a cupboard in your lower back, what would you keep in it? Doesn't exist. We made it up for Soundheap with John-Luke Roberts, an award-winning comedy podcast from Maximum Fun, made up of hundreds of stupid podcasts. Listen and subscribe to Soundheap with John-Luke Roberts now.
Welcome back to Bullseye. I'm Jesse Thorne. I'm talking to David Zucker, Jim Abrams, and Jerry Zucker. Together, they created the classic comedies Airplane, Police Squad, Ruthless People, and the Naked Gun movies. They recently published a book, Surely You Can't Be Serious, The True Story of Airplane. It's out now. Let's get back into my conversation with Zucker, Abrams, and Zucker. Was the, let's call it the house style, always intact? Which is to say, were you always contemptuous of the idea of
doing social satire or, like, if I was going to characterize the point of view of Zucker, Abram Zucker movies, it would probably be, wouldn't it be great if we did 1,000 jokes? You know what I mean?
Yeah, well, I think it was, we just thought, at the time, you have to remember, it was, the 60s had just ended, and everybody, the sketch groups were doing Nixon jokes, and we just thought, that's just so easy, and we didn't think they were funny, and so we wanted to do our own style, which was media. Yes, Jim?
Plus we grew up in an era where things were literally and figuratively black and white. I mean, TV was black and white, and it was like there were good guys and there were bad guys, and Father Knows Best and the FBI, and there were no shades of gray. And there was always this instinct that life wasn't quite that simplistic. And again, it was an instinct. We didn't like verbalize that, but we had this instinct. And I think lots and lots of kids from back then had that kind of instinct too, but they went on and got real jobs. But we just stopped there and said, wouldn't it be fun just to point out that this stuff doesn't have to be taken seriously? And again, it wasn't an intellectual decision. It was just an instinct.
It's 19 minutes after the hour, and now it's time for our daily feature, the Astrological Report. A quick reminder, these reports are not intended to foster a belief in astrology, but merely to support people who cannot take responsibility for their own lives. Joyce?
If you're a Libra and you've been hesitant about making that big purchase, hold off for another couple of days. Don't forget, your moon is in Sagittarius, not the time for reckless spending. You Virgos can expect an untimely death or perhaps a tragic dismemberment for someone very close to you. Pisces, it's a good time to pull the plug on that machine that's been keeping your daughter alive for the past 6 months. If you're a Taurus, see your florist.
I mean, if I compared the tone of the kind of parallel stuff that came from the National Lampoon around the same time, right? This kind of like post-hippie generation comedy about overturning the table. They are a reaction to similar things, right? It's a reaction to this idea of like a square, all-American, quote-unquote all-American, whatever, right? And the National Lampoon stuff is about, I would use stronger language if we weren't on NPR, but to heck with everything. It is like contemptuous of everything. Like, we're going to tromp through everything because our point of view is the greatest. And we'll just think of the most intense, ridiculous, assaultive thing we can come up with. It doesn't seem that much like that, 50 years later, but, 40 years ago, it was like that. You guys have a very different kind of overturning that table, which is, how much can we acknowledge the silliness of this, right? It's not like not flipping the bird. It's kind of throwing your arm around it and being like, we love that this is ridiculous.
Well, we also, I have to say, all the things that we satirized, we also had a great deal of affection for. I mean, Zero Hour is a great film. We love that movie.
And we love the airport movies. We love Clint Eastwood movies, and all that stuff. So
even though we made fun of them, we were making fun of certain lines and a style of acting. But we never found it detestable or—
We had very little contempt, but a lot of the Emperor Has No Clothes.
Yeah.
That was our attitude.
And it was never, as a result, I don't think any of it is mean-spirited. It's all done from a point of affection, not from, axe grinding.
How did you guys stop performing?
When the check cleared for Kentucky Fried Movie.
New from Barker Brothers, a game for the entire family. Scot-free. Your team has just assassinated the president. Can you get away scot-free? Shake the dice and see. Great, you found a patsy. Go again. Bonus card. You get Jack Ruby to kill your patsy. That's good because dead men don't talk. Oh no, Abraham Zapruder films the assassination. tough break, but now you go again. And a stroke of luck. 22 material witnesses die of unnatural causes. Now your opponent shakes again. Uh-oh, look out. Life magazine buys the Zapruder film. But you buy Life magazine and show the frames out of sequence. You're almost home. Now you must spin the public opinion board. You've got it! The public believes it. You're scot-free. Available from Barker Brothers.
So you had been performing this sketch show for quite some time. Yeah. It was like a combination of stuff from of the stuff that you had done in the Midwest.
Right.
And a lot of new stuff that we added along that.
Yeah, we did two shows in L.A. The first one was a combination of the two Madison shows, which we called Vegetables. And then the second one was My Nose. And the third one, after we had written the script to Airplane and it didn't sell, we had to go back, you know, kind of reluctantly to doing the show. And then we called it, that was a combination of everything, My Nose, Vegetables, everything. And we called it Beating a Dead Horse, which kind of reflected our attitude. We didn't want to do the theater anymore.
Were you guys glad to stop performing? Like, was that not part of your aspiration?
No, we were, We were, at the beginning, we thought, be a performing group, but... But by that time, we were thrilled to stop performing and make a movie.
I think part of the charm of Kentucky Fried Theater is that we clearly weren't actors, and we weren't particularly comfortable on stage. And somewhere that sort of factored into this sort of uniqueness of it all.
I want to play a little bit from Kentucky Fried Movie, but there is a part in this book that maybe blew me away more than anything else, other than perhaps the enormous nose that you built for My Nose that sneezed on the audience as they went into the theater. Other than that, the thing that blew me away was there's a point in here where John Landis, who directed Kentucky Fried Movie, and at the point you met him, had directed like only a very small micro-budget horror comedy. Yeah. And he had this meeting with you where, as he described it, and I felt like it was more literally than one might expect. He said, they did not know what a screenplay was.
Yeah, I think we knew that you needed a script, but we didn't know what one looked like.
We asked John, how do you write a screenplay? And he said, well, I have a one in my trunk of my car. I'll give it to you, and you can follow that. And so, I mean, we just didn't know the format at all.
It was American Werewolf in London.
Yeah, yeah.
And you didn't know even, you know, like capital letters, interior, doctor's office.
None of that. But, you know, you could tell very easily from, from seeing John's script. So we just followed that. We should have probably at some point read, a lot of structure books and things like that.
Well, we didn't need to.
For Airplane, it was fine, but we later could have movies, used it later. Yeah.
Let's hear something from Kentucky Fried Movie. So it is a sketch movie that is composed of lots and lots of mostly spoofs of serious stuff, news broadcasts and instructional movies and things like that. And this is a PSA from the United Appeal for the Dead, who specialize in telling you do's and don'ts regarding death.
In the past year, over 800,000 Americans have died. Despite millions of dollars of research, death continues to be our nation's number one killer. Hello, I'm Henry Gibson, speaking to you on behalf of the United Appeal for the Dead. Although so far there is no known treatment for death's crippling effects, still everyone can acquaint himself with the three early warning signs of death. 1, rigor mortis. 2, a rotting smell. 3, occasional drowsiness. It is also important to know what to do when you die. 1, do not attempt to drive a car. 2, do not operate heavy machinery. 3, do not talk.
What I think is really interesting is, during this period in your career, you you lost one of the guys that had moved out to L.A. with you. He moved back to Milwaukee with a new wife to sort of start a new life. Ended up founding Comedy Sports in the improv chain and making a big impact in the comedy world. But you also added a guy to the cast because your pianist had not come out to Los Angeles with you.
Right.
And the show had always had a live accompaniment in it. And you cast this guy named Steven Stucker. And in a lot of ways, Steven Stucker was the opposite of the aesthetic that you had cultivated. Describe.
Completely.
Yeah. Describe what it was like when he walked in as the, you know, seventh person you had invited to like try playing dramatic music during a serious things.
You have to remember, we were just these very straight guys from Milwaukee, and you know, our concept of a member of the troupe was another guy like us. And Stucker, I remember the first time I saw him, he drives up in this pink VW Beetle with two-tone leather hot pants and a tank top, and my heart sank. Because I thought, oh, well, this is not going to work. And then, you know, he came in, we introduced ourselves and we said hello. And then he sat down to play the piano, which was in the middle of all this construction. We were still building the theater. And he started playing.
Take Me to Your Pilot.
Yeah, by Elton John. And wow, it was amazing. And then
it's like the piano levitated. And I don't think, I was 25 or 26 at the time, and I'd never met an outed gay man in my life. Obviously, I'd met many gay guys, but growing up in the Midwest back then, nobody had outed. And Stucker could not have been any more out or flamboyant and brilliant. He had been a soloist with the Cleveland Symphony Orchestra when he was growing up. So he's this brilliant pianist and hysterically funny. And you're right, 100 or 100 and whatever degrees opposite of our brand of humor.
And as it turned out, I mean, when we were on stage, we may as well have been invisible. He was just, he got all the attention and it was great.
It's funny because, like, he is the most Marx Brothers-like of any of the things. Like, he has a Groucho-y quality. Like, obviously, you know, the deep V-neck gold lame is a little different from Groucho Marx. But it is that element of, like, going around, raising an eyebrow to the audience, flipping a table, saying something outrageous, seeing what happens, like a sort of, like, live wire quality.
Yeah, we don't really compare him to the other actors in the way of, people sometimes say, you have your actors playing it so straight, why don't you see? Well, Steve is the joke. In other words, he is the airplane, hey, Joe, where's the forklift? It's over, you know, the airplane crashes through the thing. He's the... And so we always saw him not as the cake, but the frosting on the cake, and kind of used him in a sense to come in for a punchline. So his,
I mean, he's like a cattle prod. Like he's just like zap.
Yeah. Well, that's what we wanted. I mean, and we wrote that part for him. We would never have written that part if we had not known Steven, you know, he'd not been in the show. So I don't think of so much in comparison to like Groucho or even Harpo in any way, because they're your main characters, whereas Steve is just, you know, comes in for the zinger.
And we took some jokes right out of the show, like where Lloyd Bridges comes up to Stucker and says, Johnny, what can you make out of this? And then Stucker says, well, I can make a hat or a pin. We did that on stage.
Yeah.
And and the whole the newspapers, passengers certain to die, airline negligence, and then Stucker says, there's a sale at Penny's. And we did that on stage.
And a lot of the other lines, he wrote all his own lines in it, I think. We would call him on the phone and read him the setup. And he'd just like instantly come up with a...
Like the press conference.
Yeah. Yeah, it's he was. We said, you know, we wrote him. We read. We said, what kind of plane is it? You know, and he said, oh, it's a big,
pretty white plane, red with stripes and wheels. It's looks like a big Tylenol. That is word for word. We just wrote it down.
Yeah.
I think that's one of my favorite jokes in the whole movie.
Yeah, it's pure Steve.
Well, there were other instances where we did not write the lines, like the black dudes with the jive. Those guys wrote those lines. And then what we did, we put in the stupid white guy subtitles.
When you actually got the money to make Airplane, which took years, how did you actually convince all of the Robert Stack and Lloyd Bridges people to be in this movie?
Well, we were very fortunate in that Paramount assigned a guy named Howard Koch to us, to kind of a producer. And he was he had been president of the Academy of Motion Pictures and all, a very credible, experienced veteran of the movie business. And he had worked with all those guys. So he gave us like credibility.
And it took a little convincing with some of them, like Peter Graves.
Yeah.
When he first read the script, reportedly he just threw it across the room and said, this is the worst piece of trash I've ever read and in the worst taste imaginable. And so
entirely wrong.
Yeah, right. So when his agent called Howard and said, we're passing, Howard said, why have Peter come in and meet the boys, as we were known? And he did. And so, I thought, from reading the script, he probably thought we were, a bunch of drugged out weirdos, we were not weird at all. Yes.
We were weirdos, just not from drugs.
Right, yeah.
Can you fly this plane and land it?
Surely you can't be serious.
I am serious, and don't call me Shirley.
Doctor, I've checked everyone. Mr. Stryker's the only one.
What flying experience have you had?
I flew single engine fighters in the Air Force, but this plane has four engines. It's an entirely different kind of flying. All together.
It's an entirely different kind of flying.
Besides, I haven't touched any kind of plane in 6 years.
Mr. Stryker, I know nothing about flying, but there's one thing I do know. You're the only one on this plane who can possibly fly it. You're the only chance we've got.
Did you have a specific idea of what kind of serious actor was funny to you?
Yeah, I think we definitely did. Yeah.
And B-level actors, not A-list. Leslie had been in an endless series of B-movies and television shows, and Robert Stack, too. And Graves had been, a staple of television. We'd been watching him for decades. And Lloyd Bridges was on Sea Hunt. They were, like, perfect and very, very serious.
And there were other guys that we, like Charlton Heston, who would have been good too, but he turned us down.
I mean, there's a certain kind of intense sincerity in the context of camp that brings these guys together, right? Like some of them had worked in really good things as well, but like the idea that someone who was like handsome enough and had enough gravitas to anchor something that maybe was a little bad, or certainly a little corny, like that quality of commitment to that is sort of the quality that allows them to commit to the joke version of that.
If Airplane is really about not taking stuff seriously, you have to really applaud those guys because they had whole careers that had been established by being serious actors. And in a sense, when they took those roles, they were poking fun at themselves. They were having a laugh at their own expense, which is really the essence of what Airplane was about, is not take things too seriously. And they didn't take their own careers even too seriously.
Did you know you were onto something when you were shooting Airplane? Did it feel right?
Oh, 100%. Yeah. We always knew. I mean, from when we first wrote it back in 1975, we knew. It just says, we just thought, oh my, this is going to just blow everybody's mind. And, you know, it's
I don't
be
think
great.
We ever thought it would last this long.
For
you know?
50 years.
No, yeah. 50 years. Yeah. But we thought it was, people were going to, we just couldn't wait for people to see it, you know, to show it in front of an audience.
Every once in a while, I've told David and Jerry this, if like when I'm not feeling good about myself, I'll go onto YouTube and they'll show people watching Airplane for the first time. And one thing that comes, you know, people who weren't born back when we made Airplane, and the reaction, the consistent reaction is, wow, this is so stupid. You know, all these years later, and you were touching on stupidity a lot earlier too. And whatever that is, you know, we actually kind of think, well, maybe at some point we raised stupidity to an art form.
You must have been having to figure out what's funny on a screen, like what the camera allows you to do while you were doing this. Because this was, you know, you knew little enough about movies that you didn't know how to format a script. And you had been doing stage shows for years, so you knew what was funny. But there are possibilities available to you when you have a camera that aren't available to you when you're on stage.
Except that about 20, 25 minutes of the show, the live show, was videotape. And so we actually did have a lot of experience. I mean, a lot, not,
directing,
you know,
yeah.
But directing a comedy on video. So not that we had any real expertise, but in terms of our humor, we learned how we needed to set things up.
And I don't think there's any, you know, grandiose shots in Airplane. We just, you know, we copied Zero Hour. It's shot for shot, most of it.
I think my favorite joke from your entire oeuvre is it might be, it's one of the episodes of Police Squad. Leslie Nielsen arrives on the scene and is interrogating someone out in front of a store in the foreground. And from the left of the frame enters someone holding onto a stretcher with like a, you know, a body bag on it. And as he crosses the background, the other side of the stretcher never appears, so the stretcher keeps going longer and longer until finally he's off screen and it's just stretching across the whole frame, and then the back end of the stretcher comes through, like as the stretcher is like 35 feet long. And that kind of joke is something that you clearly really loved. Like,
yeah,
there's just great pleasure for you guys in making the camera do something stupid.
Right. I think that it's very important to make a joke like that work, that there was something else. There must have been something else going on in the foreground, some dialogue, and it was only a background joke. So if you put a camera right on it, you're giving it too much attention and half the joke is lost.
We always like the idea that the audience, no matter how kind of obvious we or prominent was, that the audience would discover it. In other words, ostensibly, they're supposed to look, in a normal movie, you're looking at these two guys talking about the case and what they're going to do next. And you're not really paying attention to people walking in and out of the door or a stretcher or whatever it is. And so the idea that people at first would be looking at the two people talking and listening and then realizing that this thing was going out, the audience could find the joke as opposed to us just
pointing to it. And in Airplane, sometimes we do it, and the joke happens in the foreground, not the background. So when Leslie Nielsen is talking to the stewardess about the effects of the food poisoning, if you ate the fish, Peter Graves is in the foreground experiencing each symptom as he describes it.
Yeah.
So, and that made it funnier.
Leslie Nielsen has a wonderful supporting role in Airplane. And
In
Leslie Nielsen, I think you maybe found somebody who was both good at this, like good at the sincerity that was required to make this thing work,
right. But
also truly loved the idea of doing it. Like some of these other people, you're roping them into it, and they were glad at the end that people thought it was funny.
Right.
But it, I get the impression that Leslie Nielsen just really loved the idea that people liked this.
Right. Yeah. We heard that he told his manager after he read the script, don't tell them that, but I'd pay them to do this movie. So
well, the interesting thing about Leslie is, people ask me, were you surprised that he could do comedy so well? And I always say, after working with him, we were surprised that he had been able to draw that drama so well.
With a straight face.
With a straight face, because he's really a closet comedian. He's a nut in the best.
He's a committed fart machine.
Exactly.
Just never without his fart machine.
Yeah. And Leslie, more than anyone else in Airplane, relished saying the absurd lines with a straight face. And then with the fart machine, he used to love the idea that he was, you know, he'd be in a suit or a book or whatever, and he'd walk onto an elevator, and he'd fart, and then people would kind of say, excuse me, you know, he would, and he would just, he knew, he wanted to get back at someone in his childhood, I think. He was also an anarchist. He rebelled against authority, you know, but yet he was born with a body that looked like the establishment. So it was fun for him to use that physicality to make fun of it. And we certainly were happy to give him that opportunity.
We'll wrap up with Zucker, Abrams, and Zucker in just a minute. After the break, ZAZ share one weird trick to write good comedy for TV and movies. Actually, it's many tricks in the form of a list of rules. We'll get into them in just a minute. It's Bullseye for MaximumFun.org and NPR.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Progressive Insurance, where drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average. Get your quote at Progressive.com and see if you could save. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Acorn TV. Acorn TV isn't just good, it's brilliant. With exceptional television from around the world, their romances are more charming, their mysteries cozier, their noirs more gripping, and their comedies cleverer. More clever? Oh, you get it. Acorn TV is brilliant stories told brilliantly. Visit acorn.tv for a 30-day free trial with promo code NPR. So, in a nutshell, Acorn TV. Brilliant. Support for NPR and the following message come from the Wallace Foundation, working to develop and share practices that can improve learning and enrichment for young people and the vitality of the arts for everyone. Ideas and information at wallacefoundation.org.
Oh my gosh, hi, it's me, Dave Holmes, host of the pop culture game show Troubled Waters. On Troubled Waters, we play a whole host of games, like one where I describe a show using a limerick and our guests have to figure out what it is. Let's do one right now. What show am I talking about? This podcast has game after game and brilliant guests who come play him. The host is named Dave. It could be your fave, so try it. Life won't be the same.
Big Business, starring Bette Midler and Lily Tomlin.
Close, but no.
Oh, is it Troubled Waters, the pop culture quiz show with all your favorite comedians?
Yes, Troubled Waters is the answer
to this question and all of my life's problems.
Now, legally, we actually can't guarantee that, but you can find it on MaximumFun.org or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Jesse Thorne. You're listening to Bullseye. My guests are Zucker, Abram Zucker, David Zucker, Jim Abrams, and Jerry Zucker. They're the creators of the movie Airplane, among many other hilarious things. I want to play a clip from Police Squad, which is the television show that the three of you and some collaborators made in the early 1980s that was the precedent for the Naked Gun movies and is one of my favorite things ever. The show. This is a clip where Leslie Nielsen, who plays a version of the same character he plays in the Naked Gun movies, Frank Drebin, a police detective, and he is interrogating a suspect in a courthouse bombing.
Where were you last night?
I told you a dozen times I was at the movies.
I've got the sandwiches here.
All right, Eddie, you went to the movies. Now, what did you see?
I told you, I don't remember.
Who had the egg salad?
I don't remember.
Somebody ordered it.
You can't expect us to buy that.
But I already paid for it.
Why don't you give a guy a break?
Thanks a lot.
What's the charge, huh?
$4.58.
What are you trying to do, insult us?
Okay, $3.50. Coffee's on me.
I told you, I went to the movies. I fell asleep. I don't remember.
You don't expect us to swallow that.
All right, I'll eat it. But I don't think it's fair that I should have to pay for it.
All right, Eddie. Let's say you did go to the movies.
Okay.
You did go to the movies.
Then let's say that you were nowhere near the Club Flamingo.
All right.
You were nowhere near the Club Flamingo.
I think Police Squad is such a beautiful thing. And there are only 6 episodes of the show. I've probably watched them all 3 times. The thing that I struggle to imagine is that show on regular network television. Like, that show coming on in one of the, like, least ambitious times in the history of network television.
And there were
right?
only 3 channels at the time, and it still didn't get an audience.
So. Like, in between the, you know, in between the ambitions of Norman Lear shows and the ambitions of, you know, the Cheers Seinfeld lineage of sophisticated, what if sitcoms were sophisticated? Not even as ambitious as, you know, the time when all television comedies were dumb, but at least they had crazy ideas like what if a car could talk or whatever. Like it was just 8 is enough or whatever on television. And then Police Squad.
This was very different. And actually, Tony Thermopoulos put it well when he canceled the show. He said it didn't work because you had to watch it. And a lot of these other shows, you're doing laundry or you're eating or whatever. And so, but our show actually worked best. We heard that on college campuses, kids were getting in, going into a big hall and watching it together in the dorm. And it was a hit there because they could hear each other laugh and they paid attention.
It must've been so hard to adjust though to, from you having just an absolutely extraordinary success with Airplane and continuing to make really great work and being like, oh, I thought when you make something great, it automatically becomes a monstrous success.
No, well, in fact, there was a great deal of relief when Police Squad got canceled because, you know, we had to be, when you do 23 minutes every week, you have to be so prolific. And we just, that's not the pace at which we worked. So, you know, we were all wiped out because you're always going to writing sessions and editing and whatever. And so when it got canceled, I think, yeah, it was a little bit of a slap in the face, but we were kind of relieved.
Yeah, we were.
Top Secret was the film that ended up following up Airplane. And it is full of really funny stuff, especially in-camera stuff. Like, it is twice as inventive, like, aesthetically as Airplane was. It's just full of really great jokes about the camera.
It was great. We could get away from an airplane and a control tower.
I went to one of those airplanes. One time Paul Feig was directing I can't remember what movie it was, but I visited him and it had a whole airplane part.
Oh.
And I went to one of those airplane sets. Like, there's just in Los Angeles, just warehouses with half an airplane in them.
Right.
And I just thought, like, this is truly the weirdest thing in the world. Like, you just go visit this airplane for 4 days and shoot scenes in it. And, like, what can you do inside half an airplane? Not much.
Well, it was great for us because for our first film, everyone was facing forward and there was no room to...
No blocking challenges.
Blocking challenges. So, it was a great vehicle for a first film.
But Top Secret was a lot of different things. It was like an Elvis movie parody, a spy movie parody, a sort of general you know, 1960 America parody, like, you know, that comes with the Elvis territory, but sort of jokes about that. There's war movie stuff in there mixed in.
What did you find out, Latrine?
Well, the others. Oh, we never had a chance. It was a slaughter.
We must put a stop to this afternoon football games.
And it wasn't a big success. What was it like to go from having this, you know, falling backwards after 5 years of working very hard into extraordinary success into, oh, I guess that golden touch is not automatic?
Are you familiar with the term Harry Carey?
Yeah. Play by play for the Cubs, right?
Yeah. We were quite bummed.
Surprised. But then, you know, when we thought about it later, we weren't as surprised.
What did you realize later?
Oh, well, that, you know, you can fill a joke or fill a movie with jokes, but that doesn't mean it's going to be successful. What was important about Airplane is that Arthur Haley wrote this wonderful plot and characters with the guy with PTSD who, you know, had to solve the problem by flying the plane down and rescuing the passengers in the third act, which was that's all that the audience cared about. And the Marx Brothers were not successful until they had Alan Jones and Kitty Carlisle in Night at the Opera, where the audience cared about them and their plot. And in Top Secret, it was not grounded in reality. And Val Kilmer didn't have any kind of intrinsic emotional problem that he had to solve. So it ends with the last joke, much like Duck Soup ends with the last joke.
Did you have a different attitude about anarchic spoofing as 45-year-olds or 55-year-olds than you did as 25-year-olds?
You know, I don't think we were intellectuals enough to think about that we were writing anarchic humor. We just always kind of thought of jokes. And when we realized that, you know, the plot was important too, you know, we were better at it.
Was there a point where you, any of you were like, yeah, but I should really be making broadcast news?
No, not for me. Not no.
I mean,
Jerry made some
there,
actual.
There was a. I mean, there was. After broadcast news came out, I'm sure I said many times, "Boy, I wish I would have made a movie like that." No, but I don't think we ever really. We liked what we were doing.
Yeah,
I mean, Jerry, you directed Rat Race, which is one of the silliest movies of the last 25 years. That's not all three of you.
Well, that was a different kind of humor because it wasn't satire; it was sort of farce, you know, and a lot of you know, mechanical hijinks of things going wrong. So. Yeah, that was really fun, but it wasn't, it was very clearly not a ZAZ style movie.
You guys have alluded a few times to your, rules of comedy. So number one is joke on a joke, right?
Yeah. That's just doing two things. We like to do set up joke. It's just distracting having, you know, trying to do too many silly things all at once.
The wavelengths of two jokes happening at the same time cancel
right.
each other.
Or
out.
If a foreground character is trying to be silly and then the background is silly, you got a joke on a joke.
What's number two?
Acknowledgement. Sometimes the word winking, that's kind of what I was talking about before. Just don't let on you know you're in a comedy. You know, actors... Or even if there's a way the directors are doing it, it's just like keep them believing that it's a drama.
Unless it is like completely glancing. Like one of your exceptions are if anything happens in the briefest of moments, the audience can probably accept it as long as you ignore that it just happened.
That didn't happen. That's rule number whatever.
That's rule number 11.
Yeah, so you can skip that one.
Yeah.
Okay, what's number three?
Okay, number three is merely clever. You know, we really, jokes that are kind of just cute or clever, it throws things off. You also, I will say in general, you want to have... you don't want jokes to miss because, as David always says, it's like spinning plates. If it goes too long between spinning, it's going to fall. And that's what happens to the movie when it becomes, and that's the problem in a preview, is that there are a lot of jokes that don't work. And when you have, because you don't know yet, so you have a number of them in a row and it's too long, it's hard to bring the audience back again. Let's see. Oh, can you live with it? That's just like, you know, a license plate can be funny once, but you got it on your car for years. Can you live with it?
Or
you know?
Some joke on a T-shirt.
Or a joke on a T-shirt just, that someone is wearing.
Now, there is a description in this book of one of you guys having a joke license plate. I want to be very clear.
Jim had a license plate that he put on his Chevrolet, and it said Bob's MG. And so just so when somebody would pull up next to Jim at a stoplight, they'd say, "That's not an MG." And Jim would say, "I'm not Bob."
It's good. Jim, do you feel indicted by your own set of rules here?
A little bit. But
no, that's what you could live with,
though. It never got boring. Yeah. Right. It was always fun.
That didn't happen. That was like they're on instruments. You can do a crazy thing that wouldn't happen if you do it, if it's so short that it's, and then you go right back and it's, hope that never happened.
Right.
With Top Secret, the whole movie was that didn't happen.
Yeah right. Unrelated background, just crazy background on its own is unlikely to work. It has to be in some way related to the what's going, like the background that you mentioned of the people carrying the body out, that's related to being at a crime scene. But if we had someone juggling, walking out juggling, it wouldn't have been had anything to do with it. Technical pizzazz, you could use CGI or whatever technical tools, but if you go too far with it and it becomes just about how cool that technical that shot was, it's probably not going to be funny. Not going to be funny just for that. Hanging on is just, is good editing. You have a joke, allow for the laugh and move on.
Get to the center of the situation and then move on.
And then there are no rules. There we go.
Oh, there we go.
45 or 50 years in, do you guys still enjoy each other's company and creativity as much as you did at the beginning?
Absolutely. Oh,
yeah. No, it was fun writing the book. We just went right back into our personalities of all those years ago.
Yeah. And Jim and I would visit David in prison every day.
That's right. We got the book done. Yeah.
Did you bring commissary? I know that he asked for money for the commissary.
They smuggled in bacon. It was a kosher prison.
Yeah.
Well, David Zucker, Jim Abrams, Jerry Zucker, I sure appreciate your time, and I'm so grateful for both for that and for your work. It means the world to me, so thank you so much.
Thank you. Sure. It's been fun.
This was fun.
Thank you. It's fun.
David Zucker, Jim Abrams, and Jerry Zucker. Their book is called Surely You Can't Be Serious, The True Story of Airplane. You can buy it at your local bookstore or on bookshop.org. Or your old sketch comedy pal, Stefan, can press it into your hands when you go to visit his house. That's what happened to me. He also told me about how this second Zucker, Abrams Zucker stage show in Los Angeles was called My Nose. And the reason they called it My Nose was because they knew that the theater listing in the Los Angeles Times would say, "My Nose Runs Continuously." That's the end of another episode of Bullseye. Bullseye is created from the homes of me and the staff of Maximum Fun in and around Greater Los Angeles, California. Here at my house, I am thinking of my old pal, Dallas Penn, who passed away this past week. Dallas helped invent hip-hop blogging and hip-hop podcasting. He was also a brilliant force on video with his video group, The Internet's Celebrities. He's the kind of guy who had an engine that you can't imagine grinding to a halt. He was a really special dude. He talked a lot of mess, and he always led with his heart, and he was just a solid guy. He always showed up. and I'll really miss him. I'm really sad to have him go. So thank you for everything, Dallas. Our show is produced by Speaking Into Microphones. Our senior producer is Kevin Ferguson. Our producers are Jesus Ambrosio and Richard Roby. Our production fellow at Maximum Fun is Daniel Huesias. We get booking help from Merritt Davis. Special thanks this week to Max Fun producer Valerie Moffitt for driving out to Jim Abrams' apartment to record his part of this week's interview. Our interstitial music is by DJW, also known as Dan Wally. Our theme song is Huddle Formation by the band The Go Team. Our thanks to them, our thanks to their label Memphis Industries. Bullseye is on Instagram, at Bullseye with Jesse Thorne. You can also find me on Instagram, at Jesse Thorne, very famous. So follow those. And I think that's about it. Just remember, all great radio hosts have a signature sign-off.
Bullseye with Jesse Thorne is a production of MaximumFun.org and is distributed by NPR.
This message comes from NPR sponsor, Viking. Committed to exploring the world in comfort, journey through the heart of Europe on an elegant Viking longship with thoughtful service, destination-focused dining, and cultural enrichment on board and on shore. And every Viking voyage is all-inclusive with no children and no casinos. Discover more at Viking.com. This message comes from NPR sponsor, Oracle Cloud Infrastructure. OCI is the platform for database, application development, and AI needs. Do more and spend less, like Uber, 8x8, and Databricks Mosaic. Take a free test drive at oracle.com/NPR.
All that sitting and swiping, your body is adapting to your technology. Learn how and what you can do about it.
I really felt like the cloud in my brain kind of dissipated. Once I started realizing what a difference these little breaks were making, there's no turning back for me.
Take NPR's Body Electric Challenge. Listen to the series wherever you get your podcasts.